From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I'm not sure she would call it wanderlust, but the poet Catherine Coles likes to travel far away from home. In 2010, she ventured out as far as she could go. She sailed across the Drake Passage at the bottom of the world and landed at a science station in the Antarctic. The science part makes sense for Coles, who often uses it as a theme in her work, but the part of science that interests her is hard to get at, because Coles has said poetry explains nothing. Rather, it explores that mysterious territory where the mind meets the world. Catherine Coles has published a book of poems that were inspired by her adventure. It's about finding the language to depict the reality of such a place and what it means to see it and name it. She'll join us today to talk about the collection. It's called The Earth Is Not Flat, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Utah's former poet laureate Catherine Coles is our guest. Coles likes to travel far away from home for some reason, as far as she can get, in fact. She's been to Indonesia, up the Amazon, all kinds of different places. But in 2010, she ventured out about as far as you can go. In fact, as far as you can go. She sailed across the Drake Passage at the bottom of the world and landed at a science station in the Antarctic. Coles spent a month at Palmer Station, where she had gone to write poetry, I suppose, but also to explore. Her work often fuses words with science. It's about finding the language to depict the reality of such a place and what it means to see it and name it, she said. Catherine Coles is with us to talk about her collection. It's called The Earth Is Not Flat. Catherine Coles is the author of two novels, five collections of poetry. She has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Science Foundation, and the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. From 2006 until 2012, she served as the Poet Laureate of the state. She's also a professor of creative writing and literature at the University of Utah. And Catherine Coles, welcome back. Thanks for being with us. So I guess the obvious question is, and we'll sort of work through this, is why Antarctica? But I wanted you to start by being a little bit more specific, because you've said that you like to get outside of your comfort zone. Antarctica is the, you know, it's about as far away as you can get. But the question is why? I mean, what is it about distance from the familiar, do you think, that interests you or intrigues you? What is it about that, being far away? Is it just adventure? What is it?
There's a lot to be said for adventure, yeah. I think. And my husband has expressed himself as being glad that there's not an not a Martian artist and writers program, because right. He's pretty
that would
sure
be yours.
I'd be signed right up for that
yeah.
one. So adventure is a part of my, I guess, family legacy. We all enjoy that. But I think as far as the poetry goes, what I'm looking for is something that's more like estrangement. We talked about how it is you get at the nature of reality. And for me, at least, when I'm most comfortable is when I'm least able to understand what my true position is in the world and within reality.
So in some ways, writing, you have to disorient yourself, take yourself out of the familiar in order to find something new or say something new?
I think that's right. I mean, for me at least, the world that is most familiar to me is the world that is most invisible to me. It's the world of habit. You know how you can drive to work because you do it every day without actually seeing or remembering anything about drive?
It's kind of
scary when you think about it.
Right.
But it's that kind of autopilot, I think, that most of us are on in our everyday life. And even if you practice mindfulness or try to be alert like a poet all the time, I think it's the human condition to fall into those kinds of patterns of not seeing. And when you're in a place that's really strange to you, and I think maybe even especially in a place that is hazardous to you in some way. And
where
I
think the stakes are real.
Where the stakes are real. And actually, I think, you know, even in a place where you don't speak the language, the stakes are kind of real, you know, there as well. That's probably enough estrangement to get something done. But certainly in a place where you don't speak the language and your husband's pretty sure you're going to be kidnapped by terrorists, on the one hand, or a place where if you make a mistake when you're out and about, even if you're only a mile from your bed, it could be fatal. These are places where the body becomes alert, and so does the mind, in a way that it's not alert in the avenues of Salt Lake City, at least for me.
So, but it was more than distance. Antarctica intrigued you for more than just being as far away as possible. What else was it? Was it landscape? Was it? I wondered also in part. I wonder, is it concern for the climate? You know, did all of that come into play?
I think it does all come into play. I mean, I feel it certainly as an American and an enormous consumer of resources, including fossil fuels. I feel very implicit in what is going on in the climate. Of course, the fact that I flew to southern Chile in order to take a ship across the Drake Passage didn't help matters much in terms of my own carbon footprint. So part of this complicity and awareness of complicity is also really about these kinds of choices that we always make. But I think casting your eyes on the situation where it's most real, where, I mean, Antarctica really is ground zero for the observation of what's happening with the climate. That was a useful thing. So for me, in a way, Antarctica represents maybe extremity in every sense of the word. It's the most extreme climate on the planet, at least as far as cold goes. It's in some ways the most extreme landscape and geography. It takes, at least to go where I was going, where you can't get by airplane. It's the most extreme kind of voyage that you can take on our planet to get somewhere. There's very extreme science going on down there. The people down there tend to be extremists, as you can imagine. You don't just end up there if you are the kind of person who hangs out in your flannel jammies
and pussy slippers
most of the time. And so all of these things came together to make it a place that was intriguing to me, I think, intellectually, emotionally, imaginatively.
I want to get to this idea of orienting yourself to the landscape as we go and have you read about that as well. But, and we've talked about this before, but I want to say something, or at least talk to you a little bit about using science as a theme in your writing, because you have for years. And you've explained not so long ago you wrote this essay, and I wanted to ask you about it because you talk about how writing about science, at least the way you write about science, isn't it about, for you anyway, isn't it necessarily about explaining science?
I'm so not interested in doing that.
That's science journalism. That's not you, right? But you also have talked about the fact that it has to – you write this. It must engage the nature of reality not only as subjective – which is what poetry can be, but also, at least as I perceived it, as through a scientific endeavor. And to me, that seems objective.
Yes. For me, really central to my project in poetry is observation and being as precise as I possibly can in looking at and describing what I see and being as honest as I can with myself about my perceptions, what I'm looking at. And so for me, that's foundational to the work. There's a huge subjective component to my work. And a lot of that really happens in the science. So one of the most exciting things that happened to me at Palmer Station was actually in the women's shower room when a young biologist who had heard me read from my poems the night before came up to me in her towel and said, "I was so excited about hearing you read last night because I had never understood the ways in which what you do in terms of observation and perception really overlap with what I do, which is trying to observe as precisely as I possibly can." And we're also both trying to represent what we've observed as precisely as we can, but our linguistic methods for doing that, because our goals are different, are inherently also different from each other. And if I can just quickly say how, a scientist, because the experiment has to be reproducible, somebody else has to be able to observe exactly the same thing. So they have to use language in such a way that every word means only one thing to the greatest extent that's possible. And of course, it's impossible, but to the greatest extent
distill
that's possible.
Distill it down.
Yep. And whereas I'm trying to use language in such a way that every word has every productive meaning in play at all times.
Wow.
And that's sort of what poetic language does. That's metaphor. That's the image. That's, you know, all of these different figures of speech that we're relying on. So when she uses the word ice, she wants to be very precise about exactly what she means, and she's going to qualify that. When I use the word ice, I want it to have not only a literal connotation, but all the emotional connotations that it can possibly carry along with it.
You know, you've talked about that precise language, finding the most precise language to depict reality. And it's interesting because you've talked about how you used to describe Antarctica in the early days, a transcendent, otherworldly. But it wasn't long before you figured out, man, that does not get to it. And you say over time you were able to perceive what you were seeing, and different language, I guess, came to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what you mean.
Well, you know, I think when I was down there, it was really difficult at first just to understand what I was looking at any given moment.
Yeah.
And
why? Just you were disoriented?
I was disoriented, but also – and one of the ways I was able to connect with this finally is that I'm from the desert. And there are certain things that are happening in Antarctica that aren't so different, as it turns out, from what is happening here. And I've always described this landscape right here as being composed primarily of light. And the view outside my window, which is of City Creek Canyon, changes constantly throughout the day as the light changes. In Antarctica, the same kind of thing is happening, but it's actually much more extreme. And it was Shackleton who explained this to me as I was reading early on in my trip. I came across a passage in South where he was talking about mirage, reflection, refraction, the tricks of light, the ways in which you can be fooled by the way light is operating within a landscape that is highly, highly reflective. And this helped me suddenly to realize, oh, the reason I'm disoriented is that the mountain range outside my window is over there in the morning, but in the afternoon, it's over there.
Yeah.
In a not maybe a completely different place, but a different place.
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons that I can't get my bearing, is that everything is actually being represented to me in a certain way by the light, in a way that is not actually necessarily what the physical reality of it is.
If I asked you to read Mirage, could you?
I could. I paged you.
I never know if this is putting you on the spot. You want to say something about this piece? I mean, this again is sort of jumping off of this idea of this refraction of light and this idea of mirage.
Right.
That's where this comes from.
Yeah,
this
that's
piece.
Where this comes from. And in fact, this is an erasure poem, and this is a strategy I adopted for the first time, especially for this book. And what I did was I took Shackleton's passage and I erased most of it. I just got rid of it, which I get to do because he's been dead for a long time. And then someone who does pure erasures would then just leave Shackleton's words with the blanks between it. But I actually put in some words of my own to fill in those blanks. And you'll have to look at the page in order to figure out where his words are and where mine are. But it's about half and half, I think. Mirage. I don't need to see what is real, iridium pure, corrupted only by light. So icebergs hang upside down. I need to see what he sees from the masthead, false alarms. Oh, unreality. I'm unalarmed. In the sky, the land appears. Cloud banks masquerade. What on earth? I have never been able to tell one thing from another. Icebergs thrown into view, worst of all. Why start now? Say, sun shining at an angle might be North Dakota. On a field of smooth snow, this midnight here looks like that high noon, and I never once missed it. Ice cliffs below the horizon I have never seen so far. The appearance of open water. absence of shadows. In light, we go to sleep. The inland ice appeared. Wake to dazzling whiteness, shadows dim blue or faint. What he says, deceptive, distant, barrier, I might have said. Outside our range of vision, under this sun, something masquerades. Everything new. The face curiously human.
It's interesting, the National Science Foundation. So they had these kind of... I think it's terrific that they would ask a poet to come along in the first place. But they had certain expectations of you in terms of output. And I wonder if that was stressful at all. I mean, they wanted you to do a reading before you left. I mean, before you had been there. You would be there for a month. So what's it like, I guess, to write a poem on a deadline in that way? And how did the stuff you wrote then change?
Yeah, I mean, it was an interestingly different kind of pressure. Usually when I'm traveling, I'm making notes. I might get lines or even, you know, three or four lines together in my notebook.
The fragments at first.
The fragments at first. But I think that the intensity of the experience, and I was actually pretty worried about it at first when I realized that they expected me to have poems to read by the time I left. And I thought, oh, holy cow.
Because that's not the way you do it.
I'm very slow, usually very slow. So how am I going to do this? But it turned out that the intensity of the experience was really useful in this way. And my entire being during that time was actually devoted to this project and the thinking that was going to go into this project in a way that even if I'm not teaching during a semester at home, I'm not directed in quite that way. I'm washing dishes.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing my friends are calling me for lunch. I'm taking the dog out for a walk. I'm worried about this committee meeting, right, and this bureaucratic thing that's going on. So there, all of that was kind of erased from the equation. So I was reading only Antarctic explorers, right? So immersed intellectually in this. I was out on the water with the scientists every morning doing science with them. Actually, I should say helping them do their science, doing the manual labor that has to do. And I found very quickly that if they realize that you're willing to do the manual labor, then they will take you out in the boat with them. And it also didn't hurt that penguins kept jumping into boats that I was in and not into boats that anyone else was in.
You were good luck.
I was good luck for whales, for penguins, for wildlife.
Right.
And so I would be out in the morning and then I would be making notes and often visual notes using my iPhone, taking pictures. And then back in the afternoon, and every afternoon, I would sort of pull my notes together and do some more reading and then work on poems. And I did have a reading by the time I left. And I would say that probably three quarters of the poems that I read there on the station did make it into the book.
Although, they did?
Yes, although most of them in somewhat revised form. So the number that just weren't good enough to make the final cut for the published version was actually very small. And that was the surprise to me in the end, that already really those conversations were taking shapes that were very much like the shapes that they were going to have.
And did you take away from that, gosh, this supreme focus thing is really good for my work?
Supreme focus is really good. I also think distraction is really good.
Yeah, really? Right? Yeah.
And so I think, you know, but to have a period, you can't be that focused for a year, I think, in quite that same way.
Yeah.
But for a month or two, you know, I think that it can be a really, really useful thing. And then it gave me a momentum when I came back. It really propelled me. And so especially after my publisher, they saw a sort of rough version of the manuscript and they already had a book scheduled for right now from me. And they said, we want to do this one first for their own reasons. And all of a sudden, I was under a huge amount of pressure, not only really to finish the book, but also to get the poems out, get them published, make them, you know, good enough for that in the meantime. So the intensity actually carried through really for another almost 2 years as far as finishing. It does, probably doesn't sound intense to most normal people, but for me, given my writing pace, it was very intense. And for a while, I was producing probably 2 poems a week, which is for me, I mean, I was really, the poems were very close to the surface, and I was constantly putting down, you know, grabbing for the piece of paper, or I'd even be checking my email and then suddenly I'd be working on a poem.
Did your husband ever wonder if you'd actually come home? Do you know what I mean? Did he ever wonder she's still there in some way?
Oh, you mean psychologically come home? That's a really, really interesting question. I don't think he has worried about that. You know, I've gone off to other kinds of places before in our marriage. I think his worry was more, you know, because he's much more concerned about safety issues. Yeah. It's a family thing, right? Safety issues than I tend to be. So I think he really was worried about me being out on the ice for a month. And there's a poem in here about the crossing the Drake. And after the first time he heard me read that, he said, "You're never leaving the again."
It's so interesting, though. I have to say, I mean, what is it about you two? Because there's I'm trying to find it here, and I'm sure I will at some point. There's a lovely piece in here where you write about, I assume it's him anyway. I like thinking that it's him, about how he's the one who likes to stay home. And then the images that he creates, the flood that he creates in his mind. What's the name of the piece? It'll come to me, too. Sorry. I'm so sorry to put you on
it. It's probably Some Other Summer.
Yes.
That poem
that was written
after I got back.
Yes. I think what interested me about that was not just the simple sort of yin and yang that seems to be going on in your relationship, but I won't pry too much, but it is interesting. He's comfortable home. You like to go away for a time.
Right.
What's that about, do you think?
I think part of it is just about how we were raised.
Yeah.
Right?
Works for you.
But it works for us. And, you know, one of the things that I'm always at pains to point out about him is that he's intellectually enormously adventurous.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's not as if this isn't a streak we share.
Yeah.
There is this place where we absolutely come together on the wanting to be out there on the edge. And I really think that it's sort of, and who knows whether it's nature or nurture, right? Genetics or just the way that you were brought up. But I really think a lot of our desire to be kind of out physically on the edge, that's where our differences really are. Mm. And I think that really comes from our families and the ways in which we were brought up. It was interesting because early in our marriage, when he was becoming established as a scientist, he traveled all the time. Mm. And I mostly stayed home. And I was sometimes kind of disgruntled because he didn't want to go away on vacation. He was traveling 200 days a year anyway,
you
know. And so for him, during that period, home became an enormously important sort of grounding and locating idea and reality. And he put a lot of his energy into making our home the kind of perfect environment that he would always want to come back to. And there I was itching to be gone. And then almost at the moment that he thought, well, now I really can start saying no. I don't have to. I can send, you know, my junior faculty out to do a lot of these conferences, et cetera, that I thought that I had to do myself, was the moment that my travel life really started to pick up. And he said, "Wait a minute, I just have done all this work to stay home and you're going to be out, you know, doing this, that, and the other thing." And I said, you know, it's a different rhythm, the sciences and the humanities.
Yeah. When did you write Proposal, the piece Proposal?
I actually wrote it after I got back.
Did you?
Yeah.
I wondered about that because it seems, you know, this is you, I guess, but it's you thinking about all of the getting ready for the trip,
right.
Committing to, as you say, the practical details. And you write about, and I'm not sure if you actually did this, but you talk about poring over maps, mm-hmm. older maps, you say, mm-hmm. the ones that you prefer, the ones about the ancient creatures. And
right.
What is it about that?
It's part of it, I think, has to do with my real interest in history and the history of science and the history of exploration, the history of the development of knowledge. And I just love this idea that of the here be monsters piece of these old maps, because the monsters actually lived on the edges of the known world. Right. And so they were really creatures of the imagination. And for me, even now, and yes, I absolutely looked at accurate maps and satellite maps, right, and all of those kinds of maps. But there still is a sense in which when you're heading out for a place like that, the psychological reality of the here be monsters is still very much present, even though we don't formulate it in quite the same way. And that's about how we think about or imagine the unknown.
I want to have you read, it's probably too long to read the entire thing, but maybe the first page.
Okay.
Because it gets at that question. And this idea also of you, again, committing yourself to the practical details. There's the whimsical, there's the practical, mm-hmm. all here in a mix. You want to read this first page?
Yeah, sure. Proposal. 1, to pore over maps for months in advance. The ones I prefer, centuries out of date, know nothing useful. 2, to take notes on the map's imaginative fillips, monsters stretching out along their borders waiting to charm. 3, to learn the names of chartered harbors and islands and their relative locations from a bird's eye view, though I am not a bird, as if sitting at my kitchen table with paper spread before me will have been the same as rising and falling on wind or water, caught between cold sky and drowning. 4, to close my eyes here at my table and imagine cold sky, drowning, wings that carry a body between. My imagination, like my observation, relies on inaccuracy, approximation, desire. 5, to read journals and letters and notebooks by those who have gone before. I will learn what it might have felt like to be the first, to cross ice on foot pulling a sledge, ride the sea's extravagant curl in a small boat using my shirt as a sail, butcher and eat my dogs, which I may or may not have learned to love for something more than usefulness. 6, I promise to accept I will never be first, and have little chance of doing half those other things either. I will never be an engineer or learn how to rig useful devices from what I carry in my handbag, wire and tape, a battery, stray parts from Radio Shack. Still, I will commit myself to practical details, attend to sleeping arrangements and rigging and keeping small flames alive.
And then you write this in the piece, I will get close enough to what I can't say yet. Will you tell me? Do you know?
Well, you know, I think you talked early on or read something that I had said in some mysterious place about how for me, the poem charts that territory where the mind, and in mind I include imagination, intellect, all of those things, the mind comes up against physical reality. And I think the closeness I'm looking for is to really get that border as narrow as I possibly can. And that's the thing that, you know, when you're writing a proposal for a bunch of scientists trying to persuade them to send a poet to Antarctica, right? That's kind of the thing you can't really say in exactly that way, right? I have no idea what is going to finally come out of this. But I think what you do talk about is preparation, right? And how you're willing to prepare yourself to be in that situation.
Do you feel you got close after all of this?
I do, but I also feel that I would go back in a heartbeat, because I certainly don't think that everything it's possible to get close to I've actually encountered yet.
Catherine Coles is with us. Her collection of poems is called The Earth Is Not Flat. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the poet Catherine Coles is our guest. She likes to travel from a long way away, and she reached that boundary when she went to Antarctica. She spent a month at Palmer Station, where she had gone to write, but also to explore. And she has a book of poetry about that trip to the end of the world. It's called The Earth Is Not Flat. She's joining us today to talk about it. You have described, I found this interesting, you've described a sense of freedom down there, mm-hmm. which in some way I felt like that you wouldn't feel that. It would feel confining, you know, and forbidding and unforgiving. And like you said, if you venture out 100 yards and you do something wrong, that's it. But what was the freedom that you say you felt down there?
It is an interesting question, and I hadn't thought about it in exactly this way until just now, because in fact, when you're down there, you really are never more than 2 miles away from the station. Part of that is just the geography. If you head out walking on the glacier, 2 miles is about as far as you can get.
Yeah.
But 2 miles is also about the distance that the radios will go. And you're required, you're tethered by radio to the station at all times. And I'm not sure that I would say that most of us get in trouble at least once when we're first down there. I went out on the glacier my first day and forgot to turn on the radio and completely forgot that I was supposed to check in. You're supposed to check in every half hour. They sent somebody out to find me, the distracted dreamy poet who wasn't checking.
They were immediately regretting this, right?
It was like a search party is headed out. And fortunately, I wasn't far away. And it was a beautiful day. And the person on the snowmobile was totally happy to be out there, you know, looking for me, especially since I had not fallen into a crevasse. But there is a sense in which you're monitored and you're tethered because they don't want to lose a poet. It's not good publicity.
Right.
Right. In fact, I would assure my husband by saying, really, the last person they're going to lose down there is a poet. You know, they've got a lot of scientists, but I'm the only one of these. So in that sense, you really are very constrained by the landscape, the realities of the landscape, and also the bureaucracy that is put into place in order to keep you from doing something really stupid.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think psychologically, there's an immense freedom in being in a place that forces you to confront certain realities about what it is to be human on the earth. And one of those is you're very small. And I'm small even by human adult standards. I'm a small person, so I'm kind of used to that. But you put any sized person in a place like that, and your awareness of your own tininess and the way in which your significance relies entirely on your own desire to live and the desire of the people who love you, that you will also live, and the ways in which we put these structures into place in order to maximize the chance that you're going to be able to do that. I mean, I was no Shackleton, right, down there. I was no, thank goodness, no Scott or Amundsen. But I think that there actually is a tremendous amount of psychological freedom that comes with understanding your own insignificance within this larger context. And you can't be there and not understand, not live constantly in that understanding.
Mm. There's a piece called Walking the Glacier. I wanted to have you read. Do you want to say anything about it?
I think it's pretty self-explanatory. I mean, maybe the only thing I would say is that this is one of the few poems in the book where I'm really inside and thinking about myself,
yeah.
Right, as opposed to thinking about what's outside me. Walking the glacier. Even here, breaking surface one hard step at a time, so much of what I do is plodding along, forgetting it's easy to keep sounding myself. Do I forget what I'm saying? Distracted, my brain mutters something about an old injury it hangs on to, not even meant for me. I hear there's training for this too. Meanwhile, I find myself surprised to be unzipping under such a wind, how hard my body becomes to carry. They let me come up all alone, the whole place to myself, not afraid, it seems, to lose me. Sink, flail, and pull back out, sink again. The view, will it dazzle? I can't see the edge where ice bears itself away continually, just under my feet, the raft that carries me over invisibly splitting. If I forget myself, I could become spectacular, could throw myself wholehearted into something or off. Stop, look, blaze and shadow, so blue, my stars falling away.
At first, the title was Cold Heart.
It was.
And now it's The Earth Is Not Flat. Why?
Well, a lot of people counseled me against calling it Cold Heart.
Why?
A friend of mine whose judgments about me I don't entirely trust, but still a good friend, someone who's actually referenced in this book a lot, actually called me up when he read the manuscript to say, you can't call it Cold Heart. And I said, why not? And he said, because you are so obviously not cold hearted. And one, I'm not sure that that's as true as he thinks it is. Mm. And two, you know, for me, the title was at least as much about the place as it was meant to be any kind of statement about me. But my publisher actually agreed that I shouldn't call it Cold Heart. And I think for my publisher, it was probably about sales. So it became reckless. And then my same friend called me and said, you're not reckless either. And I said, well, that's really a matter of opinion, I think. And then we did finally arrive at this title that I was very, very uneasy about until I saw the cover. And then I was happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to – Anti-Manifesto is a poem that I want to ask you about because it made me wonder and this one, to me, wasn't just about place, obviously, mm-hmm. but it made me wonder just kind of what you think about, at least what I perceive to be this kind of blind faith in poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And you write this, that no poem ever took the space meant for another poem. No poem ever forced me to listen. And then later in the piece, I've never believed in art or its purity. I would believe if believing wrote a poem. Talk about this poem.
It's a kind of circular logic, isn't it?
Yeah, there, I mean, there it's amazing. And I want it really made me – because it for me it helped me sort of get at – why I'm glad you're here because I want to get a sense of – because, you know, getting at poetry is always difficult anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This poem was actually written for Cynthia Furse, who is an electrical engineer here at the University of Utah. And she and her research partner, Kenneth Golden, a mathematician, were down on the ice, although in a very different place at the same time that I was down there doing research. And there's actually a reference in the page from Proposal I read to, you know, not carrying stray parts from Radio Shack in my handbag, that's Cindy, who I'm referring to sort of obliquely there.
Right.
So when they came back, we all kind of got together and started having conversations. And then she emailed me and she said, I have been asked to put my journals up, you know, in blogs. We had both been asked to speak at the Marriott Library. And I think the Marriott wanted to put a piece of a poem that she had written on the poster. And she didn't want to give permission for that without asking me because she was afraid that she, as the engineer writing poems, would be stepping on my toes as the poet writing poems. And she wanted to make sure that I knew that she didn't think of herself. I mean, she was being very humble and very modest, this woman who was out living basically in a tent on the ice, fixing equipment with stray parts from Radio Shack, which I admired so much. And I thought, really? Really? And it did make me think about the way I think about poetry in the world. And I think you know that I take my poetry as an art extraordinarily seriously. I'm very dedicated to the craft of it. But the idea somehow that because somebody else for whom this was a hobby had a poem in the world, that somehow intrudes upon me or impedes me. Although I think that there are a lot of poets who do believe this, it was an idea that I found that once I thought about it, I could not participate in any way. It seems to me that every opening or possibility that the world gives us for poetry is an opportunity or a chance that we should take. And history decides, you know, which poems make it into the great beyond. That's not up to me to make that
decision. So it doesn't bother
you
that there are a lot of really crappy poems being written?
No. I am not obligated to read them. And, you know, my students – so it bothers me sometimes when my students, in order not to respond to criticisms about a poem, might say, oh, well, I really only write for myself. My response to that is, well, then you don't need me. You don't need my class. You don't need your fellow students. Go on. Go ahead. Go off and write for yourself.
Yeah.
That bothers me. It seems to me that if you want to command an audience, you should care about the craft. But I can read a line of a poem and decide that it hasn't commanded me as an audience, and I can set it aside and maybe it commands somebody else.
Yeah. Read this piece, will you?
Anti-Manifesto. No woman's poem diminishes me. The men's poems I'll take one at a time. No poem ever took the space meant for another poem. No poem ever forced me to listen. There's no theory I wouldn't surrender for a line, no line I wouldn't cast out for a nibble. I've never believed in art or its purity. I would believe if believing wrote a poem. What good would it do me to insist? The world is its own machine. The world turns and turns again, and then the world decides.
Catherine Coles is with us. Her collection of poems is called The Earth Is Not Flat. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the poet Catherine Coles. We're talking about her latest book of poetry, The Earth Is Not Flat. I wanted to you write about this idea of sort of orienting yourself, trying to decide, as you write it in the poem Rumors of Topography, where the horizon locates itself. And you also write later, and there's a piece called Exit Interview, which I actually want you to read, about how the landscape surprised you. Because you had said you had expected in the poem, you say you expected a flat glacier, you expected a white blob on a blue sea, and you hadn't prepared for, and this is how you put it, the glacier's expression, how it would change all day. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a great way to sort of get into the question of, which is the dumb question of what was it like there, but use that as a way of explaining what was it like?
Yeah, this sort of takes us back to this whole question of light and how it operates on the landscape. And we talked something about mirage. I don't know if you were paying attention just a couple of months ago when they were talking about the different reports of where the Titanic was when it was going down and how some scientists had finally figured out that there was a refractive thing going on with the ocean and the clouds and the ice that made it impossible to judge distance. Mm. So one of the things that happens is that sometimes the glacier is very intimate and very close, and sometimes the glacier seems much farther away. It changes color. You know, ice is incredibly responsive to the angles of light and how light is coming at it and whether it is reflected or refracted. So sometimes ice looks very, very white, but sometimes it is an intense, intense green or an intense, intense blue. While I was there, the sun never went down. It was light all the time. But late when the sun is coming in at an angle, you do get these incredible oranges and roses. So it looks as if there is a sunset playing out against the face of the glacier itself. And in that way, again, it's very much like the desert, right? And the way in which once you're attuned to how the desert responds as a landscape to light and how much it's made of light, you begin to be able to see it in a different kind of way. And it's a similar kind of thing in Antarctica.
Here it is. This is an exit interview.
Exit interview. No plan could account for the moment I woke into my first blizzard or for the ensuing habit of bliss. It didn't warn me how I'd stand around waiting while the wind dropped, the ship docked, my gut settled in. I can tell you what I remember wrong, how I planned one thing, did another. The map shows the glacier flat, a white blob on a blue sea, also flat. Knowing the difference didn't prepare me for the glacier's face soaring out of the harbor and how it changes expression all day, shrugging itself off in great sheets, or how the sea rolls over and back and takes us with it. I didn't learn to leave myself behind. I didn't learn to stop inventing, at least when reality stares me down. I send my mind out front to look around, and when my body arrives, everything changes, changes again the second I'm looking back. Even now, water thickens with shed ice, one floe large enough a leopard seal suns herself on it, content to wait until hunger draws a penguin close, another tender moment I couldn't plan for. When the glacier shifts, growling, it too opens voraciously, invites me to look, if I'm dumb enough to get that close, into its deep dream. I am plenty dumbstruck. I never expected the sunset would refuse to end long after I did.
I wonder, so what changed coming back? You know, what changed for you? Your perspective, surely, of course. Mm-hmm. But did it change your writing? I mean, did it? What changed, do you think, after that experience?
I think it changed my writing profoundly. It may be more for others to say, but we talked a little bit before about freedom.
Yeah.
I feel in this book as if I have and part of this is the speed with which it was written, that also gave me a kind of freedom. It released me into an understanding that I've been doing this for a long time and the craft is there and I can trust it and I don't have to worry every little thing like a bone in quite the same way. But I also think that something that changed for me is that along with freedom came what I call in the book, maybe it was in Proposal, maybe it was in the poem I just read, The Habit of Bliss.
Yeah.
And I think I'm actually a happier person since I came back. I feel as if I was transformed internally in a kind of way that allows me to live in freedom from certain kinds of details that used to just worry me. And now I'm much better able to say to myself, if I start to feel something insignificant tugging at me, you know, it's not a hospital. Nobody's going to die. We don't really have to worry about that. And that's, I think, an attitude that I have in the poems, in the writing of the poems, and also an attitude that I've been able to bring back, unfortunately, to every minute of my life, but to a much bigger piece of my life than I was able to practice that kind of strategy before.
You know, we're starting to see the season change.
Mm.
And there's a terrific piece in the book I want you to read finally, because I too am tired of winter. And this is a piece called May Day. You want to say something about it and read this finally for us?
Sure. There's a series of poems at the end, some of them that are really about Antarctica, but clearly retrospective, right, where I'm looking back, I'm remembering, I'm thinking about the situation. And then this is one of the few that is just really located right here in Salt Lake City, but I think is very much inflected by the experience of where I've just been. And I'll remind people that the spring of 2011 was that spring where we had all that snow. May Day. I sit as still as I can for as long as I can. Outside, a cloud crosses the sun, then another. In April, a wild turkey took up temporary residence in the yard. The end of April, it had snowed again. The birds scratched for acorns under the trees and dismantled the garden beds in search of grubs. She sat in one bed then and preened, lifting her feathers in outrageous circles like fans, every shade of brown, its own flirtation. Then she found a patch of sun and went to sleep. This was yesterday. I hoped she would build a nest in the high pines, but I had nothing to tempt her beyond acorns, grubs, the sunlight, a tin of seed. I don't claim to be patient. I've been ready for winter to end, ready to end any chill I may have brought back with me. And yes, the snow has melted overnight, and I can see under it the foothills were always going green, the way they do every year, and soft, a green I can feel in the roof of my mouth like velvet, suddenly present. Except where the cliffs take their stands against erosion, looking for the moment constant. They cannot win. Even I can see when I chance to be looking, how they shift, how they dust up, and occasionally shake themselves off.
Catherine Coles, her collection of poems is called The Earth Is Not Flat. Catherine Coles, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug, for having me.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.